And we're currently working on those. We also monitor the actual application of the standards, and that we commented on the standard chart of accounts that are being developed for municipalities, because the standard chart of accounts needs to be suitable to enable entities to report the information that's required by standards of GRAP. And we also promote the application by writing articles for some of our stakeholders. And that year we wrote one for Ernst & Young International on the first-time adoption of standards. We wrote articles for SIGA, the Institute of Government Auditors, SICA, and for the Institute of Municipal Finance Officers. In terms of the objectives to realize the potential of our people, I think when you look at our costing, it's important to understand that all our staff, four of them, we are six people, four of them are chartered accountants, and it's important in developing standards that our staff stay up to date, and therefore training and development is an important aspect of our cost structure. To ensure that our technical staff are appropriately trained in standard setting and in other personal development issues such as leadership skills, presentation skills and other interpersonal skills, we have a coach for them. One of our key focuses are the retention of key staff, because if we lose any one of our staff members, it results in a significant gap in our ability to actually deliver in terms of our work program. And if you look at that year, at 2013-14 financial statement, you will see that 66% of our costs that year were staff remuneration. So CA is highly paid. And to keep them, we need to continue to maintain the salary. Then communication with our stakeholders is really important in developing appropriate standards and making sure that the standards are understandable and that entities can actually implement them. As a result, we issue a newsletter after every board meeting. We write articles for a number of journals. Last year, we reached out to all nine provinces, and we reached for the first time a number of users of financial statements through the post-implementation review. If you look at our stakeholder outreach report in our annual report, you will notice that national departments are not currently participating in the process. The National Treasury is, COPTA is, and some of the departments, depending on the topic, but because they're not required to implement the standards, the preparers are not really participating. So this year our focus has been on trying to reach them so that they can prepare for the implementation. In terms of our objectives to manage the ASB in an efficient, effective and economic way, besides good governance is important. We have received a clean audit ever since the ASB was established. In the last year, the internal audit did a financial review and identified no issues. They did a review of our performance information and noticed that we didn't include the number of training days in our quarterly report, so the quarterly report now includes that statistic as well. The quarterly report is the one we submit quarterly to the National Treasury as our oversight department. And they also identified some improvements that we needed to make in our business continuity plan and our disaster recovery plan. I'm happy to report that all of those things were corrected. The other important thing we did last year was to ensure that we comply in full with the information and communication technology policy framework that was issued by the Department of Public Services and Administration. And instead of a phased approach, we made sure we comply with it in full in the first year. If you look at the financial performance, I'm going to briefly discuss the drivers of our costs and then talk about the summary of our results. I've said already, we have six employees, four of which are chartered accountants, which means that we have to have continuous training. Our remuneration increases can exceed CPI. We have four board meetings a year with at least three technical documents per meeting, and the board members are paid at the rates Auditor General for the work done by members of SAICA. The board members are also the members of our management committee, and there are 4 management committee meetings a year. Because we have an extensive state of older consultation, we have travelling costs and other related costs. We have international involvement in that one of my staff members is a member of the International Public Sector Council Standards Board. They have 4 meetings, 4 days each time, somewhere in North America, generally Canada or the US of A, which means there are travel costs and hotel accommodation for her attendance of that meeting. And we have a very small office. We only have 250 square meters, but it means that we have very little flexibility in our costs. And when we try and develop a budget, a balanced budget for the National Treasury, in terms of the regulations, we tend to use training as the balancing figure, because that's really the only cost where we have some ability to delay the expenditure, even though it is important that our staff remains up to date. If you look at the summary of the results there, you will see that our revenue is the positive payment from the National Treasury, and the other income is mainly interest and some attendance of fees that we receive for serving on internal audit committee. As I said, 66% of our expenditure is staff remuneration. The other significant areas are board remuneration, travel, training, printing and publishing is mainly our annual report, and our website where we maintain where all our documents are published and notices published in the Government Gazette. That's really the only cost in that area. And then administration, of which the rental for the offices are the main item of expenditure. The large increase from 2013 to 2014 in that specific area is for about 18 months now we were short one staff member, and in order to maintain our activities in terms of our work program, we sourced one of the projects out to external accounting firm. An external accounting firm as an alternative to having an employee. We do not like doing that because they only work on one project. We must staff to only work on 3 or 4 projects at the same time. When we use external consultants to develop a project for us, we spend a lot of time transferring skills to them in drafting that paper and doing the research and making sure that it's in the required format and the right issues and questions are asked. So we don't find it very effective to use that as an alternative. But when you cannot find the right staff, you have to make a plan. So that's why we do it, but we don't do it on a regular basis. That's the main area of our results. Since 2008, when we had the global financial crisis, we have managed to renegotiate our lease from 10% escalation per annum down to 8% escalation. We also renegotiated all our costs with our suppliers and have managed to make some savings. But when your transfer payments, 9 million rand, the savings that you can make is very limited. In the current year, we have renegotiated a lease from next year. The escalation is now down from 8% to 5.5%. And we have also managed to convince the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants to pay for travel costs for workshops that we do for their members to enable us to get input on our documents. And they paid that travel cost on our behalf this year. And we've cancelled all our subscriptions to newspapers, anything, international journals, buying the international handbook, all of those things have been cancelled. accept annual charge of $5,000 to IFAC for the use of the International Public Sector Accounting Standards, and then the professional membership fee of the four chartered accountants in our employ. When we look at beyond 2014 as a result of the NTBF, we've been advised that our transfer payment has been cut by $438,000 for the 2015-16 year and by $657,000 in the year thereafter. And the only way we can do that is if we have no trading, no travelling, and no printing, which means we will not be complying with the DFMA in that we can't table our annual report in a printed format, so we will only give you a CD in future. And also, we have filled that vacancy in September 2014, so our staff costs are really not very flexible. And the only other way we can continue to reduce costs is if we do reduce staff, and that is counterproductive. So the Accountant General has agreed that he will enter into discussions with the budget people on our behalf to try and see if we can reverse this, because one of the things that have been identified in the recent local government summit by the Minister of Local Government and Minister of Finance is that we need to develop another type of reporting for users of financial statements at local government level. They have to do the annual financial statements, but in addition to that, there needs to be some sort of communication, a citizen's report or something like that, which puts the information about the municipality in a much simpler level so people can understand what services did the municipality deliver and what did they do in the year. So in order for us to do that, we do need resources. And it's important that we do it sooner rather than later. So we do have a big problem going forward in regards to sustainability. Cutting our travel expenses is a big problem because we go to all the provinces to have meetings, roundtables, workshops and discussions so that we can get feedback on the standards during the development stage. We found that people in South Africa do not write comment letters on our exposure drops. They prefer to have a face-to-face discussion with us, and we take notes, and that form the basis of some of our comments and our proposed responses to changes to our document. And those comments are reflected in a document on our website as well. So travelling costs is a big issue for us. If we look at the 5 years going forward, we would like to review our legislative mandate. We've been advised that public entities all have their own legislation rather than just a chapter in somebody else's legislation, and that it would be more desirable for us to have legislation that deals with our specific activities. There's also questions about exactly what our mandate is, whether our mandate is to only look at financial statements or to look at broader financial reporting. If you look at the annual report, is it only dealing with the section of financial statements, or should it also look at things like the accounting officer's report, the performance information in that annual report? And then the other thing that we are going to do that we haven't done to date is we're going to establish a project group to look at the barriers to implementation of standards of GRAP by national and provincial departments and see what we can do to help eliminate some of those barriers. Until national and provincial departments are also on standards of GRAP, we're really not fulfilling our constitutional mandate, which is that all three spheres of the public sector must have uniform accounting standards. So for the rest of the strategy, it's business as usual, subject to resources limitations. Then in July, when we were here, the chairman asked us to to identify a few key issues that we have that we would like to bring to your attention. One of the things that we need to do during our consultation is, especially when we look at post-implementation reviews, is to consult with the users. And you, in your capacity, oversight capacity, is one of those users that we would like to consult with. But not only you, also the Standing Committee on Public Accounts and other relevant standing committees. And we would like your assistance in establishing a mechanism so that we can consult with you on the requirements and the standards and whether you get the information you need in order to exercise oversight. We also asked your support in the clarification of our mandate and asked you also to promote the capacity building that's needed by including the requirement to teach standards of GRAP at universities and other higher education institutions. We, the public sector, get staff from universities and from other training institutes, and they're not taught anything about standards of GRAP, the finance staff that I'm talking about now. And it's really important that that's included in their curriculum. We have also talked to the School of Government. They include standards of GRAP in their curriculum, but it needs to be wider than that. And that's really the issues we raised in the letter. And that's my piece, Mr. Chair.
That's it. Thank you very much, Kitsi. You are joined by.
Yes.
Maybe you should just introduce the member of the chair.
Good morning, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. Apologies for being late. There was confusion about which venue I need to go to. I'm the chairperson of the Accounting Standards Board, Vuyo Check.
I'm not sure, Mr. Check, if you want to make any additions to the presentation that has been made.
Chair, one of the things perhaps we need to alert the committee about is the Use of Official Languages Act, which requires us to have our documentation in two different languages. And that's quite an important asset to actually help the understanding of the accounting standards in the other official languages. So that is a project that we will be embarking on to make sure that there's a wider use of the accounting standards. And it would help with some of the implementation at the municipal level, where we perhaps can be able to decrease the lack of understanding and also decrease then the audit findings that arises due to the lack of understanding. So it's quite an important project that we'll be embarking upon. And then secondly, in terms of the budget, there's a huge constraint on the budget and with hopefully with the mandate being clarified, so we're engaging with the Minister of Finance to help clarify the mandate if we are able to look at broader broader reporting rather than just the financial statements. Then that would mean there would be some resources that then can be made available to allow us to be able to fulfill that broader mandate. So that discussion with the Office of the Accountant General, that would bring those resources to the ASB. So there is that ongoing engagement with the Minister of Finance. So those are the two issues I just would like to add. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation and the addition there too. Members, now it's your turn to maybe pose questions on the presentation. I'm noting Honorable Makosi, Honorable Kakana, Honorable George, Honorable Ross, as well as Mama here, in that order, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I think let me welcome the presentation However, there is something that I'm just a bit concerned about, and that is, you know, if you are involved in the standards generating space, one of your key performance areas should be training, not in what, I'm not talking about inward looking kind of training, but I'm talking about, you know, outward looking training, that's training municipalities, training all the different people. And you must remember, whether it's a municipal manager or whoever, all of them one way or the other have to play a role in the whole process of implementing these accounting standards. And local government especially, I know that they've been going through the process of professionalization. And I'm not sure whether you shouldn't be looking at what FSB has been doing, and I know that FSB, because I'm also from the retirement funding administration industry. FSB, you have to write those exams with FSB, you know, to be in the sector, in the financial services sector. And this way they are also able to generate some income from that. And given the fact that the whole issue around, if you look at the way municipalities, I'm going to comment more on municipalities. We set ourselves a target of clean operation audit by 2014. We only achieved 9%, and of course we are making a loud noise about that, the fact that we have achieved something. If it was a session and you only got 9%, the patient will be dead. Now, we are saying there has been an improvement. To me, I think that's mediocre. That's mediocre. You know, you can't really celebrate 9%. And that speaks to the role that you should be playing. I do understand your financial constraints, and probably it's one area that we need to, in fact, yesterday when we were discussing, you know, all the cost-cutting measures, one of the things we were saying is that it shouldn't be across the board. We've got to be able to look at where, you know, where we have, we can't just apply uniformly, you know, we've got to look at where we need to be applying that. And I think your institution is one of those institutions where we really need to seriously consider, if we want to improve the governance standards in this country, we really need to consider resourcing it more so that you can play into that space. In fact, I really don't think that what you can even do, you can even take even people that are already accredited, and they become part, they have to be trained by you, and you become like a quality assurer, and you are even able to generate money from that, but you make sure that, you know, whatever exams that have to be written, everybody adheres to that. Because the major problem in local government, I can tell you, you bring in a sociologist to be a municipal manager, he has to comprehend these standards, and there is no way of this person understanding the standards unless this person has gone through a formal training that is assessed and accredited. And I think this is the space that I honestly think you should be playing on. But finally, Chairperson, I just wanted to know, given the fact that your board only meets 4 times a year, I just looked at your annual report and I see that you sometimes have people that are not really regular. It is concerning because you only meet 4 times a year, am I right? And obviously, if it's 4 times a year, you expect that, given the major task that you have to perform, you expect that at least you will have 100% attendance, and possibly, maybe you might have one odd one. But I'm looking at it, and it's a bit concerning to me. I'm not sure if you're taking people that are not really committing themselves to the process, And I'm just raising this because we are confronted with major challenges, especially in the space of compliance and so forth. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Just to ask one direct question, as I'll be adding on what the Honorable Kozo was saying. I want to establish with the CEO whether have all government institutions, especially municipalities, provincial and national government, moved full swing into GREP accounting standards, or there are still those who are not into that. The second issue, I think, also speaks to what Honorable Makosi was saying. If you look at municipal arrangement, currently there are strategic alliances that I can't say whether it's COCTA or SARGA within institutions of higher learning, that they have done certain programs for Section 57 managers and CFOs and municipal managers, including finance for non-financial people, you know, those kind of programs. And I think it will be important for you to look at those programs and see if the as a standard generating body, you cannot be able to clean that space and make sure that you also participate in line with what Honorable Marcos was saying. I think I would want us to go to the annual financial statements. If you can look at, can you put it on there? The...
Because you can just copy it and refer to the slide presentation.
Yeah, the... Then, when you look at the how you have been faring, or what, the revenue that you have been getting from the three outer years, you see, the first year it will be your 2012-2013, if I'm not wrong. It's somewhere in the region of 11 million. And then the next financial year, if I'm not wrong, it's 10, it's 9, and the outer year is is it 9 or 11? The summarized results. Have you seen them? Yeah. If you look at your summarized results, your 20, the 3 year cycle, yeah? On 2012 and 13, you are sitting somewhere around 11 million rand, and your staff remuneration was at 7.4 million rand. But you managed over the years to reduce it to 6.6. It will be interesting just to see what mechanisms have you employed to you to assist you to move from that to that, including the board remuneration expenses. You were progressively reducing some of those things. So, just if you can share with us how you have been managing to come through that. Because I take it that you still want a motivation with the accountant general to assist you to expand on some of your programs and other things. I think they may be able to use this as your test case to say this is how you have been projecting yourself and all those things. Thanks.
Thank you.
thanks very much for the presentation. On this issue of the mandate, I just want to get some clarity. If I understand it correctly, maybe just tell me, you decide or you have inputs or just explain exactly what it is that you do in terms of the how of the reporting. So in other words, you don't determine what is reported, you determine how it's reported and etc. Now, I understand you're looking for a change to the mandate to get involved in the what is reported. You can explain it when you answer. Now, my question is, if that is so, have you had any interactions? I know that you talk about the Standing Committee on the Auditor General. Have you had any interactions with the Auditor General on this, and also any interactions with the Accountant General? Because I do think that there is, I think, a fairly sound argument to say that if you are determining how it should be done, then perhaps it isn't a good thing to be involved in the what. I don't know if they should be together or whether it should be separated, but it's an interesting food for thought. Then, on the, something that's been on my mind for a very long time is the price of annual financial statements. Bring them together with these glossy things, you know, so you see reports that are very, very thick and they're full of photographs of a whole lot of people that hardly anybody's ever going to look at. And I see yours is fairly moderate, you know. So I'm just wondering, have you given any thoughts to setting standards on that? So, for example, if you came along with some kind of, I don't know what it is you do, but if you issue a decree of some kind to say that when you are doing financial statements, this is a technical requirement that we need, but at the same time also perhaps there's stuff that you don't need. And also, for example, really all a set of annual financial statements is a set of statements. Don't have to be that very, very long. The whole thesis and the photographs and everything, that could go on a website somewhere if you want to look at it. So in theory, in fact, in practice, what you could get on a set of annual financial statements is something like this with the numbers on it. And we would save millions, maybe even hundreds, on that across the whole of the government sector. So I'd like your views on that, please. Thank you.
Honourable Ross, thank you, Chair. Just to note that, of course, it's a very important department, and the County Standards Board has a vital role to play. But my concern today is that I sense that there's a lack of progress with regards to certain areas. And if I may take that up with you. I think in terms of what you said, in terms of your reporting formats to be developed still on local government level, is it not late in the day that it's not developed yet, seeing that you have six CAs in your structure? It's a very direct question, and it's an unfortunate question, but certainly local government has left us in the lurch in so many, many towns. And I'm quite sure that if I understand your presentation today correctly, that you would like to strengthen your oversight role, not just in terms of the format that you would like them to present, but somehow to get more information from them, more understandable. You would like to make it easier for the public to understand. But certainly this format, is it not long overdue? You had six CAs in your department. Certainly, if they look at all these statements from local government, is there not certain practical recommendations that could have been done years ago? And are we not perhaps in the founding stages where we should be in the concluding stage? Secondly, also with regards to barriers of implementation, barriers to be developed, implementation with regards to better results from different entities and local government. Once again, what barriers are there, and why is it so late to be identified that you now realize you have these barriers? And then clarification on your mandate. Also, the mandate, is it not long overdue that the mandate should have been changed? What has happened? What were these changed circumstances in terms of your mandate now to be revised? And of course, I agree that you would like to extend it to universities and all the other issues. I'd just like to see in terms of your letters, yes, the oversight, I'm sorry. Yes, with regards to stakeholder engagement, I think my colleague Nkosi has alluded us to the importance of training, and I think that's very important. Not only developing the systems, but see that everybody is trained as far as possible. And how could your full-time personnel be employed, say one of them at least, to do continuous training just in terms of local government? That should be very useful.
Yeah,
Thank you very much, members. Let's get back to the business of the day. Honorable Nkomo, you are on board. Let's welcome the real chairperson. Honorable Nkomo.
Thank you very much, chairperson, and thanks for the input from Ms. Tina Swartz as well as the arrival of the gentleman sitting next to her, whom I've seen, I think it's Mr. Jack. Yeah, I think I've seen your name on the annual report. I would like to first state that there's two documents which I'm going to be engaging with. It's going to be your annual report as well as the slide presentation. On the slide presentation which we're given, as the master, I would call you the masters of grant as well as all these international conventions on reporting and everything else. How quickly do you think in the annual report an issue which was raised by Ms. Swartz is going to be actually featured, and that is the matter of addressing a report? I think it says from the accounting officer as well as matters of performance, because those are the core issues on what REP is all about. When do you think that is going to start featuring in your annual report? Secondly, the matter of if I may just quickly go over it, the matter of your technical, realizing the potential of all your people. We do acknowledge that chartered accountants do come in quite small numbers in our country, and we do understand as well why they need to be paid quite well. But then let us talk about it in comparison to chartered accountants that are way out of your system. How is the payment so that we can compare and actually realize how important it is to actually keep people? I think it's 66% of your costs actually go to salary. On the matter of the national departments that are not participating, I think one of my colleagues asked about it, but I would just like to know that if you've reached all nine provinces, how come then the national departments are not doing anything? Because, you know, it also needs to move up so that we can get an understanding, because we as members of this committee need to ensure that we play our role effectively, in the sense that if there are matters where we need to exercise recommendations or our oversight, then we can do that. So we need to find out a bit more about these matters. And then you also spoke about the internal audit identifying some housekeeping issues. Let me just mention one or two areas which I noted in your annual report. The first issue is about the systems of internal control, where it is stated here that the systems of internal control and risk management is not feasible. It's page 25 in the annual report. Why is it not feasible? Because we expect you people to be trendsetters. We expect you to actually be the people that can say things are moving okay. We do understand the small offices. That's how it is at times. There's also this matter of page or on your slide, the summary of results, where there was an issue about outsourcing the job. I think that is where you said one of your chartered accountants had left, and then you outsourced the job, and then a sort of an external person did the job. I think that links up with what Honorable Pinky asked earlier, that how did you get it right with your finances, irrespective of outsourcing the job, but the money seems to have been okay, and yet what I got between the lines as we're getting the presentation was that there was more money that was used due to that. And I think we also need to address the issue of the savings
savings that we're talking about. How did you come to getting a savings? Because, you know, when it comes to a savings, then we're talking about different issues. Then the last point is the council all subscriptions. I think you've got it here on the cost containment. How are you expected to survive if you cancel all subscriptions and you are not able to interact with the outside world? Because you need to do that as a professional body so that you are updated. But now if you cancel most of those professional, I think you mentioned a few dollars where you said this is how much we take out. But one gets worried exactly how will you move towards this in order to ensure that you are updated on matters. You are updated on matters. And lastly, I do know if the matter that was addressed by Jeff when he stated that the languages are quite important. We acknowledge that. But it would be important, Chairperson, as well, if we were to say to ourselves issues around reviewing the legislative mandate, how much have you started doing, and how much would you like us to do, because we have a responsibility as well, establishing project groups and identifying barriers to grab by national and provincial, including local, because even local governments also need to take their part. And I think you stated, Madam, that it's business as usual, although it's subject to resources and limitations. That's a very worrying statement, especially the part which you have not written on the slide, but which you mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before I allow the chair maybe to make a comment or to proceed with this session, let me just pose some few questions. In as far as your equity plan is concerned, are there any clear targets, because we are not sharing the details of that equity plan here, and how are you intending to deal with this big challenge of scarcity of skills to ensure that those targets, the generalization of those targets, is not a compromise? And then secondly, I'm not sure if this is part of the broader mandate that you are requesting to be maybe expanded. But what is your role in terms of ensuring compliance to the standards that you set? Let's ignore it. Let's just focus on the task at hand. How do we ensure that you play a role in as far as compliance on standards that you set is concerned? I'm asking this because I'm not even sure what are the current mechanisms, what is your role in those compliance mechanisms, because from where I'm sitting, as you set standards, it might be difficult for those standards to be policed by other institutions without their involvement. What is your role in terms of ensuring that adherence, I mean, to these standards, I mean, this is realized? And then basically, on this request of broadening the mandate, what are the new areas that you would like to be accommodated in the broader mandate? Because it becomes very vague to me, as you say, broadening the mandate. I mean, which areas, because the mandate is clearly articulated in the Act, I mean, in the PFMA. So which areas would you like to see being included in this defined mandate, you know? And obviously you might give reasons why, in as far as you are more especially your competency level is concerned, you know. One of the determination as part of remuneration, can you just take us on board as to how is this done? Because I realize that you are very central with the CEO in terms of even employment or recruitment in the institution. I'm not sure how you do issues of performance management. Who is determining the level of bonuses that must be paid to individuals, those who are who deserve bonuses at the end of the day. And how independent is the opinion of this independent audit that you are submitting to Parliament? I'm asking this because, you know, sometimes it's difficult to determine the relationship between yourself and some of these institutions. More so since you are in the same profession with the the skills that of course are required for auditing with the same institution. But also, what is the role of the AG's office in auditing? I mean, your performance as I think those are my questions, Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity afforded to chair the session. I'm officially handing over then to the real chair. Thank you.
Can I just ask a question? Firstly, is there anybody in this committee, of the GA members are listening, and since we're very open here, even to Masani and whoever else has come in, is there anybody that's utterly appalled or disgusted with the whips chilling of the meeting? Even Sandy is not disgusted, right? So I think the chair should chair through whatever time we finish. Secondly, the Accounting Standards Board is here. So I think they will do a financial assessment of how much I should pay him from my salary. Thirdly, I don't have anything much to say except that we put this, I just need to remind you, I did speak to the whip about this earlier, or at least to Alan as well, that this, you wrote to us on the 23rd of July, some 5,000 years ago. Now, with the other entities, colleagues, I wrote a reply immediately, within like a few days, right? And I sent this stuff to the Cindy and to the Minister and DG, and we got replies. I think Alan has sent you some of them. In fact, only three entities. You were one of the three. But in your case, you are raising very big issues, which I don't have a mandate, it seems to me, to actually take decisions on. Like, IRBA was simple. This is like you're raising big issues here. So that is why, before they part, I would like members to give opinions, because I have to now write a letter and so on, reply to you, and to also send letters to the extent I have to the Minister and DG and so on. So on these matters, Mr. Chairperson, I would like the colleagues to comment, and then I'll also offer my own views. That's what I'm pleading for before the 1.5 hour ends. But can you please check what is the problem sitting here, really?
All right. I think because this document that you are referring to, Chair, was presented, the summary of was part of the broader presentation.
Yes.
So I'm not sure, because I think at some stage, according to the appeal of the Chair, we might have to apply our mind on these issues. So I'm not sure if those issues are thoroughly clarified to members. So as at an appropriate time, we are able then to conclude on these issues. You know. So the assumption is that if there were no questions around those areas, that simply says members thoroughly understood the message from the ASB. If that's the case, then I will allow you then to respond to questions.
I think in my comment in person, because you also indicated that there's a session the CEO is going to have with the accountant general or something. And indirectly, one is in support of that initiative, and maybe at our level we can also be able to track where the discussions are, whether Treasury is now coming into the picture to assist the ASB in as far as some of those core activities that we can implement are concerned, because it is in our interest that they are well capacitated to be able to give the necessary support to public institutions, especially municipalities and other areas. Yeah.
Honorable
Thomas.
Yeah.
Sure, no, our I was interested in the reports from ASD about the question that was asked by Honorable Jobs around what exactly they talking about policy review, what aspect of it are they looking at, and will that not be in contravention with, or will that not contradict with the role of the AG, will that not elevate them to playing a referendum player or something like that? I was very interested in them answering that question.
Okay, maybe we should allow you to answer questions then, because I don't think that's new thing coming out of. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Perhaps I can start and then I will defer to the CEO. The question around board meetings from Honourable Makosi, to look at or having four board meetings.
Mr. Chair, let's just take a hand from a member at the back. Honourable Chair, please.
I'm sorry, comrade, you know I'm slow in thinking, so all of a sudden I'm thinking, so I think I can ask questions and comments. So if you,
yes, you can proceed, Honourable Member.
Thank you. Chair, this is a very interesting organization. That's the standards of accounting. Now I'm going to remind, No, because I'm going to talk about you here, and now you Now, in our previous lives as chairpersons with unis, and then we once raised an issue that it is not enough for government departments to only report on financial matters and not report on performance. We were part of those people who were lobbying for that, to say the AG should be empowered to look at performance so that we can juxtapose expenditure with performance. That's what we were lobbying for. And therefore this organization has a responsibility. GRAP is the best mechanism. Of course there are other better mechanisms. SEF, for instance, is one of them. And I said at one point in this meeting, I would want us to have a template that when you put your strategic plan and your program, that template should be able to alert you if you are failing in terms of implementation of your program, so that it alerts you in advance that you are underspending, and it must limit issues of environment and deviations, so that managers should not, as and when they feel like, move money that that was not spent for the programs that they committed in the programs that they will spend them for. So that template will be able to go to the head of the department, the DG, the CEO, whatever, and alert them on time. And I once also suggested that on a quarterly basis, government departments should report on performance so that we should not track the performance at the end of the fiscal year. And start to ask, why have you not spent this money? On what have you spent? We should see and monitor this process from the beginning. So that if it's lack of skills of managers to implement, that matter is addressed not in a punitive manner. Not in a punitive manner, but to assist people to have relevant and requisite skills to do that. Now, you raise a very important issue in your document. You say that our tertiary institutions does not have the program, the GRAP program, to help those who are going to be managers to grapple with the whole program. Now, Makosi was saying, is there a developmental program that you have? Of course, you'll be limited by funds. I mean, there's many government departments and other entities and institutions. You will not be in a position to fund all of them. But you might find that there are other private sector institutions that are interested in committing funds. I don't know how, Chair, to help in this training. Because whilst we're waiting younger students to graduate and from FET colleges and other institutions to come come with the knowledge. We need the implementation as in yesterday. So what do we do in the meantime while we still train people to FET colleges? And where do we get the additional funds? Even the fact that the minister has now reported that you're going to cut spending. So that's the reality of the challenge that we have. So Makosu was right to say the institution will have an interest on helping. Because if you monitor accounting, you might want also to have an element of development to ensure that people get the requisite skills. It's not going to be of any use to criticize government officials, whether it's municipality level or provincial government, that they don't have the requisite skills. When we know the historical background of South Africa, that it was by law that people were prevented to get the skills. And now, it's haunting us today, and it's blamed to this administration. As if it is this administration that created this skills backlog. It's not. And it's now faced with resolving the issue. And I don't want to bring a lot of politics in it, because it can take us the whole day. Now, there are clear recommendations, Chair, that the SB is making to us to consider. One of them is to involve the AG and other committees to take a decision to help, which I don't think we differ with that recommendation, honestly, because it's helping us to move forward. But the chair says, let's consult broadly, engage, have everybody who's part of the decision-making in one room, and we take that decision together. So that when we implement, we monitor the implementation of that decision, at least we all agree. So that it's not us who take the decision and then those who must simply say, well, we don't have the money to do it, and blah, 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 and then it becomes a future exercise. So I think we should have that platform where everybody, including the UTA General, to tell us how do they now audit performance. Because we made that recommendation when I was still in Scopa, which was, I don't know, 20 years ago. So we need to move to that direction, Chair. So it's my humble submission that the approach should be, let's have all the stakeholders decide and take a decision, look at where the money should come from, the training programs, that specific investment in the skill to make sure that people understand. Because it starts from the level of an assistant director when they make a submission. It doesn't start from the director level and up. It starts there. So there was a manager I used to respect when I was for government, Noreen Ngombane. Noreen Ngombane involved us when we were assistant directors in understanding the reporting models. He said it doesn't only affect senior managers. So he made us to sit in the executive committees of the Department of Trade and Industry in the system, so that it starts from the younger ones going up to understand the reporting mechanisms, so that by the time you hold the senior position, you don't struggle. In fact, Chair, in my lifetime, I wish for a president who's got a master's in economics, who wants that one. Thank you very much.
Honorable Makosi.
I wanted to emphasize that I was proposing more of your own FSB model, because the FSB model is not necessarily waiting for government funding somewhere, but people pay for that. They pay a fee for that training, and I also wouldn't like it to be sub-delegated. And I'll tell you why. I've lectured at VET. And sometimes you get people that really don't understand the standards. You are generating the standards. And even if you look at your SAB or whatever, any standard generating body, they will always have a strong component of training. And they will have a way of assessing whether people have acquired the competences that are required. And that you can actually be getting from the client. I'm just proposing, and I'm saying maybe you might have to look at the FSB model, because it's been working very well.
All right. I'm going now to allow you to answer. Dimitar, you wanted to say something? One thing that I've realized is that, including some of my questions, most of the questions asked are answered in your detailed document, but I suspect there's some members are like me. I didn't go through it. I was relying on your summary. But going through it now, I realize that you are covering all the areas that you think must be accommodated in this call for an expanded mandate. But I will allow you to talk to those. But I'm just saying I appreciate the fact that they are properly captured and explained in this detailed document that you're sending us.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I just want to add two points the CEO from what the honorable members have been saying. Just a quick one on the training and conventions and all that. There has been, I had discussion with a couple of my colleagues from other audit firms. There's a room for collaboration. I just want to find out if you have actually considered that, for collaboration with other stakeholders in terms of speeding up the training or the particular confession. You know, there's an appetite from some of them who would want to engage government supporting, even the universities as well, teacher institutions. There are those that are very much interested in, you know, helping. So if there is, they have not considered, I think it's worth considering collaboration with other institutions. I mean, GRAP is not far off completely from the GAP, you know, so I don't think it will be a bigger issue as such. There will be specific issues there, but in terms of collaboration, I think that can help to consider with other institutions there. One point which emphasizes what the honorable members have been saying about the training and all of that, without even enough capacity to take training yourself as an institution. One other point, there's a recent, I did a research previously where Public Service Commission was part of the consulting institution, where, you know, the constitutional says, according to the constitution, there is a constitutional requirement that government entities ought to report in a sense that a lay person will even understand what has been said in terms of government performance or in terms of financial report. And I liked what you mentioned earlier on to say you're working on getting that framework in place. And I tend to agree with the honourable member that that's actually long for 2% in constitutional requirement, that when I pick up a annual report from the entity, government entity, department, it should be able to make sense for me as a lay person as opposed to a financial person or as opposed to a technically balanced person. So I think that is a very, TSC has also raised that to say, in some of the issues, people don't necessarily engage with government, not because they don't want to, but because they don't understand.
Members, please, with due respect, I'm not saying let's not convert, but let it not be to an extent that is now making it difficult to hear the one who's making a contribution. Okay, proceed.
Thank you, Chair. So, basically, I'm saying that the framework is longer due because I was saying the finding, one of the findings was that it's not that citizens don't engage with government because they don't want to, but because what government often put out there doesn't make a lot of sense to many people. So I think that framework is longer due. So if that can be sped up, I think it would help. And also engage with other institutions who have said that would help. Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay, over to you now.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Kwaza's question around the board meetings, what we've done now is we've restructured the board into having a technical committee. So because we've been conflating the governance and the standard setting into one, so what we are now following the best practice model of then being able to have a subcommittee of the board that looks at the technical documents. And then we'd have the board still maintaining its governance function, but also overseeing the technical, but without having to, because what we have currently is project groups that does the technical documents, and then it goes to the board, and then we have long board meetings looking at each and every line item. So in order then to make sure that we streamline the process, we are creating a technical committee. That will then allow then us as a board to have those four meetings that are not very packed. And also for quality control, it ensures when you have a technical committee, you can be able to co-opt members to be able to make sure from the technical that the quality control is right. And I guess it goes back to the issue of mandate. When we look at training of external people, what we can do is to be able to popularize the standards and so forth, but the mandate is currently within the National Treasury, the Accountant General's office, to look at the training of municipal officers into the standard. We give input into the guidelines and so forth, because we do not have, it's not within our mandate, and that is why we're also engaging with the School of Government to be able to play that influencing role. But it's we would not have the mandate nor the budget to be able to do that. And that is why we then were able to also say, let's try to lobby the higher education institutions to take this role, because then you're able to get many providers who can be able to deal with the training needs. And our role is we can even give input into the textbooks to make sure that they are correct and that they cover the issues adequately and in terms of interpretation. And so, but perhaps when we have this broader discussion about the mandate, this could be one of the areas then that could be part of the discussion to think, should our mandate be looking at the training? And it's a good point you're raising around the FSB. But I guess the difference with the FSB and us, FSB would be more like IRBA and being a regulator. So we come up with the standards, and National Treasury ensures that they are actually applied, and the Auditor General ensures that they are applied correctly. And so, therefore, we might not want to cross that line. So we need to maintain that independence. So whereas with the regulator, it's a different type of model. But I guess when we do engage on this mandate debate, that could be one of the issues that could be covered there. And we welcome the point that there must be selective, properly applied cost-cutting measures. We don't want to have cost-cutting that also impairs basic delivery and that could be then detrimental to Treasury. And we've been engaging with Treasury on this matter, and there are ongoing engagements to say we can't just need willy-nilly blanket cut, because then it would affect the service delivery and it would also affect the quality. It's a very great point to actually take back to also with Treasury. And then there were questions around the bonus or the equity plan target. So when we look at the, we have six employees, and when we look at our profile, out of those six, we would have four technical people, one black male, one black female, and two white females. And so, and in line with the DTI's equity targets and the employment equity targets, it's kind of difficult to meet, because with four technical people and with support staff, which are also two black females, it becomes very difficult to be considered a small entity. And though we do follow the employment equity requirements, and there's no clarity yet on the DTI's BBBE requirements, which was now passed on the 24th of October, that requires state-owned entities to meet those employment equity targets from a BE perspective. And so the DTI has not clarified how such entities as the ASB would be classified in terms of meeting those. So we are engaging with the DG of DTI, Mr. Lionel, in October, to provide us with that clarity. And then when we look at the bonus determination, there is a formula that is used as part of the remuneration. There is 20% that would be related to the bonus. And the way we do it is based on the organizational performance, and I think 60% on personal and 40% on organizational performance. And we use this as part of the retention strategy. And linked to the question from Honorable Nkomo on the staff payment comparison. So we do those benchmarking and look at IRBA, we look at the SAICA and the FSB and the AG to see how we actually track. And then from those comparisons, make sure that we're not far off from in terms of the overall package we provide, which is why in the presentation our increases might be slightly more than CPI, and it's due to that comparison that we've done. And so we are competitive to a certain extent, and which is why that we've been able to retain our staff members. And perhaps, and then the question raised by Honorable Kekana on the revenue. So on those slides, it actually shows its budget, so it's not actually 2012 figures. So it was the budget column, the third column. And now what has happened is that because we've had a vacancy, so that's why we haven't been able to fully utilize the budget. And then secondly, some of the board members are employees of the state, so they don't actually get paid. And therefore, when we budgeted some of them, so because they don't get paid, so we had budgeted that they might be paid, but some of them actually ended up being employees of state, and therefore there was a budget saving. And this budget saving then has been utilized to, and we, sorry? Yes. Bikini. Yes, because it was a deputy auditor general, and then you got appointed, and then we have now somebody in his place representing to present it in the board. And so from the saving, we applied then the rollover to be able to utilize it to translate our standards into three languages. And so that's how we've been able to then utilize that saving. But it's but now we've filled the position in September, and so therefore when we look at the end of the year, we'll be closer to budget, and that saving being utilized towards the language translation. And perhaps you can answer some of the
maybe before you proceed, let me just remind members that the short man in front is still the chairperson, so please let it be done through me. The engagement with the presenters will be done through the chairperson. I just wanted to remind you of that basic principle of a meeting conduct. Honorable Nkomo, yes.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm surprised at how much I'm getting an invisible beating, because I said through you, Chairperson, Mr. Jack has spoken about three official languages now. We just needed information on which ones are those three. That's all that we needed, because the last time we spoke of just translation into languages. So we just needed that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Chair. So the languages will have the English being one, and then we have Zulu and Afrikaans. And so this is based on the research in terms of the widely used languages. So these are the initial languages as the requirement to start off with three. But there's no limit in terms of can we do more if there's resources. But the initial three are the two. I mean, that is English, Afrikaans, and Zulu.
All right, you can proceed as well. Any other questions?
Thank you. I think I should start with clarifying the issue about mandate, because that was one that was most people wanted to understand that. Our mandate in terms of the PFMIA is to look at the financial statements only. And if you look at an annual report, apart from the financial statements, there's the performance information and the departmental information and information about human resources in the annual report. Now, our mandate at the moment is limited to financial statements, but we want to have it widened to be financial reporting. And why we want to do that is internationally, the International Public Sector Accounting Standards Board has spent the last 3 years in developing their framework, conceptual framework on which accounting standards are based. And they have changed their mandate from financial statements to financial reporting. And what is excluded from financial statements are really financial report, performance reporting, the discussion and analysis by management, and other projects like long-term sustainability of government. And they've issued report, recommended practice guidelines on those areas. And being involved as a member of IPSAS B meant that we have been involved in the development of those standards. And therefore we have experience in those areas, and we'd like to have those documents also issued as standards in South Africa. Now at the moment, the National Treasury has issued a framework for performance information, and that has all now moved to the presidency, to the performance monitoring section. And so we're not questioning whether or not those things should be reported. We agree it must be reported, and that's what's required by the PFMA. What we really want to do is assist with how the information should be presented in the financial statements, so that it's easily understood by users of the financial statements. So it's really only looking at the financial reporting of that information, and not what the information is that will be reported, but the how, in response to the question. So we don't want to extend our mandate into all kinds of things. We really want to limit it to information that is already reported in the financial statements. Performance information is linked to that, and management discussion and analysis is also linked to that, because that's really a verbal report on how the money was spent, and not just rand and cents the way it is at the moment in the financial statements. Reporting to citizens is a new area of development. Governments across the world really only look at financial statements at present. The US is the only one that has a citizens report, which is a four-page document that they issue annually on how the federal government has spent the money and what it means for ordinary citizens. And we are looking at that as a way for municipalities to report to citizens. And it should be things like how much water was delivered, how much water was lost, how much electricity was bought from Eskom, how much was distributed and used by the municipality. Simple things on what the municipality has done. So many roads are tarred. So many kilometers of road have still are not tarred. These are the facilities that were built or made available to citizens. So it's simply about what actual service delivery has taken place in the municipality. And it's a new area. There's no examples that we can follow on by looking at best practice internationally to determine how to report it. And that's probably why we haven't done it yet. But simply, financial statements are supposed to be the tool in which financially informed people hold governments accountable. And in many cases, well, in South Africa, it's through you as the electorate that's performing that function on their behalf. And so, we are looking at a change, and we're not sure how we're going to do it. And maybe we should have done this years ago, but our mandate was clear. It's financial statements, and it's general purpose financial statements. Because if you have the capacity, like you do, to ask for more detailed information, then you can direct the department or entity to provide you with more detailed information. But people, the man on the street can't do that. And that is what we try to achieve with financial statements. In order to ensure that our mandate doesn't grow enormously, we're looking at activities that are being performed by the Office of the Accountant General, in that he has staff that set the reporting framework for national and provincial departments who are still on the modified cash basis, they haven't moved to GRAP. And so he's saying, should that all that standard setting not be in the same place? So that's part of the review of our mandate in looking at what exactly they're doing. And also to avoid the referee and the player being the same person, the Auditor General, in terms of its legislation, can determine the reporting framework when legislation is not clear on what the reporting framework should be. And so every year they publish a government gazette that says there's entities that have to prepare financial statements, hospital boards, for example, tribal accounts, those kinds of things, and what the reporting framework should be. He's saying that he can't assess compliance with the framework if he's also setting the framework, and he wants that moved out of his legislation into our legislation, because we have to determine the reporting framework for that. So it's looking at those things, and there's no clarity around it, and we would really welcome your input into that whole process. Once it's been approved, that we can actually review our mandate and draft appropriate legislation. And then we will be engaging with you on that specifically. Now, to be honest, I'm totally new to this whole thing, so I will need a lot of guidance, and I really hope that I can make use of your assistance in that regard. When we talk about barriers to the implementation of GRAP, we really are talking about, thank you very much. what is currently preventing national and provincial departments from implementing GRAP? And it's purely systems. The integrated financial management systems that are currently being developed by the National Treasury and by CETA for the National Treasury. And I think they're at the tender stage to continue with that project. But until they have proper systems that also allow them to have records of their receivables and their payables and their fixed assets and all of those things, they really aren't capable of implementing accrual accounting. What we, our project is aimed at is identifying those things in our standards that are not system driven and that they could start complying with. Barriers are normally things like the skills. Do the current people in the department, provincial and national, have the skills to implement accrual accounting? Cash accounting is fairly simple. Accrual accounting needs more skills because you must be able to do reconciliations, and they need to be trained in how to do those things. And then, obviously, there's people and systems and the cost of implementation. And I think if you talk to municipalities, they always talk about the cost of implementing standards of GRAP, and a lot of it is as a result of little understanding, for example, thinking that we need to have an assessment of condition of assets when it's not required by standards, or that you have to use external valuers to determine the value of property and plant, and that's not a requirement in the standards. So those are additional costs that can be incurred that we're trying through training and awareness building to ensure that those misconceptions are continued into the national and provincial departments as well. I think Rui Martinen has mentioned the training is not training to departments. National, provincial, municipalities are not within our mandate. It is the mandate of the National Treasury, and they accredit training organisations to provide the relevant training. We also work with other professional organisations like EMFO and SICA to ensure that they include standards of GRAP in their training programs. And one of the programs that are working on that is the AAT program that SAMHSA has, which is training accounting technicians in expanded software so that they are able to perform their operations both at a municipal level and also at the departmental level. So yes, we are aware of a number of training initiatives, but it's not across the board. It still needs to be standard in all the universities. We know, for example, that the university, and we've worked with the University of Cape Town to work on a postgraduate diploma on standards of RAP, but we want it to be pre-graduate. We don't want it postgraduate, because not most people just study and have a BCom and then they start to work. So it must be in the BCom, it mustn't be if they do postgraduate work. The question of the lack of internal...
Sorry, let's make sure that we work to wrap up, because our time is limited. Remember, we still have to make a determination about your requested areas of assistance. So let's just work towards that.
The
one
thing
another member who wants to make a call.
Thank you. I wanted to make a follow-up on generally accepted reporting standards. If it's an international requirement for people to report both on performance and financial statements, isn't it the responsibility of the accounting standard board to ensure that those generally acceptable accounting standards are adhered to? Like you say, that it needs to be taken away from the AG, but be put on your own legislation. At what level have you engaged intensively to show the importance of being compliant? Because we belong to international organizations, so let's get back to that. It has fine treaties in terms of having to look at international standards. So it needs to be enforced. And to what extent do we harmonize that? And what are the challenges? Because that's what we need to deal with. As far as what the legislature will make recommendations be based on those clear issues, except the recommendation, of course, that you made, it will also follow up to what I said that needs to be done, and looking holistically on what others will be raising as prohibitors to the implementation of such recommendations. So if you can, you can clarify that, I think.
I think both the Auditor General and the accounts in general are members of the accounting standards board. So they have been party to the consultation and to the whole discussion about building up our mandate all along. And they've provided us support throughout the process. They are happy that this should be the responsibility of the accounting standards board. But we also have to get the agreement of the Minister of Finance, the agreement of the performance monitoring, the minister responsible for that. The legislation must be clear. At the moment, there is no clarity. Because on the one hand, it says promote financial management, and on the other hand, it says set standards of GRAP for financial statements. And there's a gap between the two, and we need to be clear about the responsibility. At the moment, the framework for reporting of performance information has been set by the National Treasury, and it doesn't deal with reporting of performance information, and we want to deal with the reporting of performance information. But there's agreement among the AG, the Accountant General, and us on this whole change. I just wanted to answer one more question, and that's with regards to the ASB and its internal controls. Because we're six people, you cannot have a proper system of internal controls with appropriate segregation of duties, i.e. the person who places the order is different to the person who records it in the accounting records, who is different to the person that released the payment. You can't do that. I can do all of those things, and therefore an appropriate system of internal controls are not possible, because I can override all the controls because we're such a small organization. So we have to put alternative processes in place to enable us to have proper internal controls.
And one of those things is the management committee, which is a misnomer because it's four board members who all are the management committee. And they do the review of our management accounts and review of variances and monitor the actual accounting and reporting by the staff. So they're performing a post a review after the transactions has already occurred, because there can't be something to make sure that those roles are separated before they take place.
Can I add to that, that there is a delegation of authority which then keeps the checks and balance on the CEO, that she can approve certain things above a particular amount. So that does make the board a little bit more operational than normal in terms of the delegations, but because it's such a small entity, that is why then that control needed to be there. And also to have a separate audit and risk committee is not feasible, which is what we've said here, and that is why we're sharing the audit committee with National Treasury and the risk committee with National Treasury.
Thank you. Sorry, you are not yet done.
I'm almost done. So it means that we still have internal audits that come and do the internal audit. Because the Auditor General is on the board, is a board member and is consulted on the setting of the standards, appointment of board members, remuneration, all of those things, he is not our auditor, and we have an external audit firm, SABNT, as our auditors to make sure that there is independence. And even though I'm a chartered accountant and I belong to SAICA, and SABNT employs people that are chartered accountants and also belong to SAICA, we have professional rules and code of conduct and ethics like that to ensure that there is a proper independence in the whole process. Thank you.
All right, thank you. One small, can I remember, in terms of processes, we are supposed to be adopting a report on the institution as part of the broader BRRR processes. And as part of adopting the report, as it's a well-known practice, we will be accorded an opportunity, obviously, to look into the committee's position on the presentation. That will also include other areas that might not be covered, that's observed by members, that members would like to pay specific attention to. And my humble suggestion, Chair, because I don't see us doing justice to this request. The only thing that I think we should do as a suggestion to the committee is to give an indication that we will be looking into the requested areas where you are requesting assistance as part of the final report of the committee. And based on that, I think the chairperson will be guided as to how to respond to your request, you know. So I don't want us to rush this process, because I think looking into areas that you want us to focus on or maybe to assist you on, these are different areas that will need us also to engage with other departments or maybe other committees for that matter, so as we are able to come to an appropriate determination as to how I'm going to assist you. So my suggestion is that let's allow that process to come in as part of that stage when we deal with the report of the committee on this institution. That is my suggestion to the committee. I would like the chair to maybe give an indication.
No, I agree. Ultimately, that's what we're going to do. But the report is going to be available, I think, by Friday. We just need some guidance so that people drafting the report know what the committee thinks. We leave it to them. They might come up with proposals that don't reflect the feelings of the majority. So we're not going to cover it in great detail, but the first thing is, can I just ask a question? Have you raised these issues with National Treasury? So some of the issues you deal with here, strictly speaking, belong to the purview of the executive. Parliament can have a view, and we will obviously have our own independent view. What is National Treasury saying about this changing of the PFMA? Because I know they're very loath to make any amendments.
The Health and General proposal, and it's
actually his proposal. It's actually his proposal that separate legislation on to clarify our mandate. So, but we still need the minister. We still need to talk to the minister about that.
These things, have to be done. Whatever the report says. So the first thing is, I don't see what the problem is. We are suggesting to you, you speak to the DG, Cindicia, and the National Treasurer, the Minister's Office. They should convene you in the first instance. Yourself, the Accountant General, the AG's office, right? You ask about things to do with Parliament. The committee writers won't be able to deal with that. We have to decide here. What are we going to say? Now, you're asking things like, you must be frank. You see, the Solicitor General came here, and we said to him, look, the report you've done is startling on the demographic profile of skills. In fact, he's one take on it, he resists. I have tried repeatedly to get the House specific for it to actually put this on the agenda, but agreed to. Now, you presuppose a degree of cooperation we as a finance committee can have that actually doesn't exist. So, insofar as you are making all these points, I don't think any member of the committee would disagree, unless somebody wants to say it now. The proposal here is that we, facilitate a mechanism, that's what they're asking for, right, a mechanism. I'm speaking, we have to take a decision about, you want a mechanism that brings together the committee and yourself. Now, as far as that goes, colleagues, I don't see a problem. What is the problem with that? Why don't we put it in the report that we'll have a subcommittee, a multi-party subcommittee of three people, working with them, we can decide who serves on it. So I would like to suggest that the second proposal is what we accept it, and we ask the report drafters to put it in there as a draft. That is our proposal. The third is, you ask about interaction with other committees. The most we can do is actually write to the House Chair. So those are three things that I think are reasonable to say that the committee drafters should put in, rather than leaving it for them to draft it when they don't have guidance from the committee. And this letter was written to us actually on the 23rd of July. And in fairness to you, we should signal to you at least that this is where we tentatively at. When the final draft comes, the members of the collective will decide. But those are three things for which I'd like to just begin to hear. They're not major issues. So request them to meet the executive to discuss this issue properly. And so secondly, that we would agree to set up a joint structure with the subcommittee. Thirdly, that as far as interactions with other committees, that be done with the House Chair. And the fourth suggestion, an amendment to the PFMA, we think is linked to point one. You should engage with the National Treasury first, and then tell us what the outcome is.
Thanks.
Honourable Chair, I'm going to speak for myself. I suggest that we be given a time to look at these recommendations based on the things that I said, so that we don't hastily take decisions that we have not applied our mind. These things, we see them for the first time, some of us, yesterday. So we need time to engage. And like I said earlier on, there are affected parties here that will really want to hear their input. So that it's not only the Accounting Standard Board that engages with them, but we are also having that opportunity. I don't know, it's a suggestion that I make, but I'll be subjected to the majority of you.
Well, I think that should be a fifth element of it. What we seek to do is facilitate. It's a point she made earlier, I forgot about it. Actually, I agree with it. Facilitate a meeting as part of this process of all the stakeholders that Tandi Tobias Pokola said. That should also be a recommendation. If we leave it in the abstract, then the researchers don't know what to draft, and on Friday morning we'll have to get the report, and they won't know exactly what guidance the committee is giving them. So I think the point made by Tandi is correct. We should include that as well. We're taking no decisions, but we're providing guidance.
direction. We're not deciding that the PFNA should be amended. We're not deciding what your role should be. We're saying there's a process issue. So that, you know, this is where we're going forward. And that we can even put a deadline that by the end of, by the first quarter of next year, we should bring all the stakeholders together, as Tony suggested, to look at these issues.
Thank you, Chairperson. Now that I understand what is being sought here by the Accounting Standards Board, I think it sounds like a good idea, and I would therefore support movement in that direction. Also, as I mentioned about my concern about some of the financial statements or the formats that we receive, enormously big books, I do think that this needs to be looked at. So possibly that if there was a mandate for this board to have an extended mandate, it could also then look at prescribing in some way the limits that the entities should go to, the departments should go to when they do their financial statements, because there's only certain things that we actually need to have in the reports. So we would be supportive of a process in that direction.
Thank you very much, members. I think our research team, I want to say those will be responsible for drafting. It's not a final report, by the way. There's a draft and at some stage it will come back to us, and we will ensure that it's properly enriched to accommodate, I mean, what we take from this presentation. So I think you are appropriately guided. Thank you very much, and feel free to communicate with the chair's office or the committee through the chair's office. In terms of areas that you are not clear how to deal with. You are more than welcome to this family. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Members, we will now allow, because we are almost 20 minutes behind schedule, we will now allow the CBO to take us through the presentation on the impact of investments in our country. I wonder who will be leading the presentation.
Can I ask who wrote that document? Is the position that present?
Which document?
Investment.
Well, let's allow them to present and I will comment after, just for the sake of time.
I think we can all recognize that we're we are bombarded with messages stressing the importance of investment on what seems like a daily basis. We often hear political economic commentators in the media identifying the need to increase investment in South Africa to stimulate growth and promote job creation. But why does investment matter? Several countries, including Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, have actually achieved periods of high economic growth in the absence of significant investment inflows. In many cases, the inflows have actually been found to be a response to economic growth as opposed to a driver of economic growth. Now, the question is then, why do countries compete with one another to attract investment? Well, conventional theory suggests that this is a result of supposed potential positive spillover effects that stem from investment. And when I talk about spillover effects, I'm talking about the potential for job creation, skills transfer, for technology transfers, amongst others. The National Development Plan and other government policy documents subscribe to this notion and explicitly say to identify a critical need to promote both domestic and foreign investment in South Africa. So, before we get into the kind of meat of the presentation, the first chapter in the report has a chapter called What is Investment? And what we try to do there is just outline some of the key investment concepts that one needs to understand before looking at the impacts of investment in South Africa and other countries. So I'm just going to run through some quick definitions. So your first basic definition to look at would be the difference between investment and consumption. This is fairly simple. An investment is simply an asset or item purchased today that you intend to generate some kind of income in the future, whereas consumption is just purchasing an asset for its immediate use. A more important distinction is the distinction between gross fixed capital formation and investment flows. These two concepts are commonly used by the South African Reserve Bank and National Treasury. You'll hear them all the time. And the question is, what exactly do they mean by these two concepts? Well, if we look at gross fixed capital formation, what we're talking about is a measurement within a particular year, within a particular time period, of the amount of money spent on fixed capital. And fixed capital would include your property, your machinery, and your equipment. Okay. Plus any additional changes to inventories. That is what's meant by gross fixed capital formation. So actual money spent on physical capital goods. This is slightly different to the concept of investment flows. Now, investment flows can be thought of as inflows of money into the South African economy, both from residents and non-residents, and are commonly classified as either direct, portfolio, or other. So start with direct investment. Direct investment is basically when a company, foreign or local, invests in an enterprise with the intention of exercising control over future decisions. So that is a direct investment. People often talk about domestic or foreign direct investment. That simply is a way of distinguishing where that capital was raised. If the capital was raised overseas, you would refer to it as foreign direct investment. That's your FDR, your common FDR that you hear. Second category, your common category that's particularly relevant to South Africa, are your portfolio investments. And portfolio investments typically involve the purchasing of shares and bonds. And the intention here of the investor is not to manage or control the underlying investments. Here, they're simply interested in some financial return. And critically, their investment horizons tend to be much shorter. So when they're interested in buying stocks or shares, there's a lot of movement of money in and out of those assets, whereas opposed to direct investments, you're looking at much longer investment horizons. There's a third technical category that the Reserve Bank uses called other investments, and it basically captures all other inflows that do not fall into the direct or portfolio categories. And there are some technical categories within that I'm not going to go into. So just to give you an example, to illustrate the difference between investment flows and gross fixed capital formation, consider the following example. A foreign corporation uses its own capital, say an American corporation will raise funds in the U.S. It will then take those funds and it will buy a majority share in a locally based company, a South African company. Those funds flowing into South Africa is an inflow of funds and can be classified as foreign direct investment because they intend to take funds and may use a portion of it to pay down its debt, and then may use another portion of it to purchase, say, for example, a new piece of machinery or equipment to expand operations. The money they've used to purchase the equipment is classified as gross fixed capital formation, not the entire inflow of funds. So that's actually the distinction. Another way of thinking about those three categories there, direct, portfolio, and other, are as sources of funding. So they essentially are how we receive the money before we spend on fixed capital. So the next chapter in the report is really kind of the bulk of it. And what we wanted to do here is, in answering the question, what is the impact of investment in countries like South Africa, we looked at a fairly wide-ranging amount of research. We did a literature review, and we came up with the following. So you'll often hear it proposed that direct investment, so of any kind, is a driver of economic growth, with the assumptions that the benefits to the recipient country outweigh the costs. Now, an overview of the research for and against this proposition actually suggests the following. Firstly, direct investment funded locally tends to result in net positive effects, so the benefits outweigh the costs. And the reason the theory proposes for this, or the research suggests, is that it is because of backward and forward linkages. Now, what do I mean by linkages? A link is simply when an economic activity leads to the creation of another economic activity. This is referred to as a linkage. So in development terms, you can think of the more linkages you have, the more development you have. Okay. So when you have a South African investor who raises money locally and invests in a local company, there are a number of reasons why that individual or that investment might be more likely to result in positive spillover effects for the country. Some of the suggestions are that domestic investors are less likely to repatriate profits overseas because they're already locally based. They're more likely to invest in entrepreneurial skills of locals. They're less likely to develop capital-intensive technology that would suit its objectives and not the objectives of the country. There is, however, no consensus on the net effects of FDI, or foreign direct investment. So there are several reasons why this is actually a bit of a murky subject, and I'll get into them now. Several business practices have emerged over the years that limit the potential positive spillover effects of FDI in developing countries. Some of the examples include your transfer pricing, your profit shifting, importing inputs as opposed to using local distributors or local manufacturers. Favoring capital-intensive operations where predominantly highly skilled labor is employed. It's also been found that the use of contractors is fairly common for some of the foreign investors. And there's limited technology transfers as a lot of the R&D work is actually done back in the home country. So the practices described above have raised doubts as to the relationship between an increase in FDI and economic growth and positive spillover effects. So what actually turns out to be crucial with respect to FDI is the degree to which linkages with local suppliers are created. So all FDI is not created equal. So what is crucial is, once the FDI is made, to what extent is that local entity embedded within the local economy? That tends to be crucial. Further research we looked at shows that actually the impact of FDI is not the same for all sectors across the economy. Interestingly, a key finding was that FDI flows into the primary sector tended to actually have a negative impact on growth, while flows into the secondary sector, such as manufacturing, had a positive impact. The impact of FDI flows into services showed no discernible trend. So clearly it is too simplistic to classify FDI inflows as either all good or all bad. It seems like a more useful approach to me would be to assess who actually benefits from FDI and whether or not it contributes to the development of a developing country. So FDI inflows have therefore been found to be neither sufficient or a necessary condition for economic growth. It's more likely that it is about the quality of FDI rather than the quantity. So that renewed surge in FDI in developing countries in recent years, and that is a trend of severe or several imbalances. So if you look at the table on the screen there, what that shows is your profit remittance outflows over a period from 1995 to 2003 for a number of African countries. So when a foreign firm will invest in one of the developing countries, they will bring capital into the country, and that's their initial investment, initial inflow. Then over the subsequent years, capital is actually exported out of the country through a number of means, usually dividend payments, royalties, compensation fees. A lot of foreign workers are brought into South Africa who then send money back home to their families. But if you consider there's actually a deficit in many cases for many African countries, what that does is it assists in creating a situation where these countries are running current account deficits, much like South Africa, which puts their currency in a particularly vulnerable position, which has all sorts of implications for inflation, for interest rates. But this certainly has been one of the more troubling unintended consequences of the surge in FDI. So just the final point here is really our take-home message from our literature review, and that is to say, from the perspective of the state, the process of encouraging and managing FDI flows appears to be a delicate balancing act. The state may attempt on one hand to ensure that FDI ultimately benefits its citizens, and on the other hand, they've got to ensure that the conditions they impose on foreign investors are not so stringent so as to dissuade future investment. So the focus, certainly from our view of the recipient state, should therefore be on developing, monitoring, and evaluating appropriate policy instruments to ensure that FDI flows genuinely contribute towards development objectives. I'm going to hand over to Rashad. He's going to cover the next chapter where we looked specifically at the South African investment case.
Sorry, I can hear you, but I can't see you. Honourable Chair, thank you for the opportunity. FDI and growth in South Africa, if you look at this chart over here, the grey bars show our growth performance since 1994, and the green line shows FDI as a percentage of GDP, so it allows us to actually look at how our FDI has trended over in this period. South Africa has obviously experienced a considerable growth in FDI levels since 1994. This was to be expected given, you know, we end of sanctions in the early 90s and late 80s. We were reintegrating into the global economy. More capital was coming back into this country following the divestment that took place prior to that. And so FDI does increase and peaks in 2001. So it's 0.3% in 1994 GDP, and it peaks in 2001 at 5.7%, which is relatively high, and the next slide will compare this to other countries. But what is an interesting take-home message from you is when you compare growth to FDI, there's no very clear relationship. And in fact, the years of high growth, that's 2004 to 2007, 2008, FDI is rather jumpy. It fluctuates quite a bit in terms of its level. Illustrating to us at a very high level that the relationship isn't really clear between FDI and growth, despite the rhetoric out there. This is not a very strong contrarian view, but it's important for us to think about this. We can't throw terms like "we need more FDI" simplistically around, and I think that's an important take home from here. So it's quite volatile in that period, despite the fact that growth since 1994 in FDI was 1.5%, and you'll see when we compare this to other countries, we don't perform that well. So this slide, 1994 to 2013, comparing South African FDI, that's the first line over there, we average 1.5%. Now, if you look at our peer countries, the BRICS countries included in there, as well as some other countries in our development cohorts, we don't perform too well in terms of attracting FDI. 1.5, other countries that perform more poorly than us in this period of Turkey and India. Mm-hmm. But Turkey and India are known for high levels of domestic investment, so direct investment sourced locally. And if you look at post-financial crisis, so the third column of the page, 2009-2013, that's the most recent period following the crash of Lehman Brothers and the financial crisis, which began in the United States in 2008, we haven't recovered that strongly. In fact, we haven't really recovered. So prior to 2009, we averaged 1.7. Post-2009, we're averaging 1.4. Now, it's interesting to see other developing countries have actually, you know, experienced a resurgence in their FDI level, whereas we haven't, particularly two South American countries, Brazil and Chile. Chile is important because it's also a mining economy, and then Indonesia. What's interesting to note is one of South Africa's companies, a South African company last year, invested some of millions of rands in Indonesia in a ferromanganese smelter. And a lot of that iron ore is actually coming from South Africa. And these are some of the reasons that allow us to suggest that there are other factors, domestic factors, preventing further investment in the South African economy when we compare post-2009. So it's not just the effects of the crisis. When we compare gross fixed capital formation, so this is total investment in real assets on the ground, and real investment assets on the ground, South Africa has performed relatively well since 1994. You can see the upward trend both in the grey line and the green line. South Africa has performed quite well. And if you look, it's averaged 16% of GDP, that's gross fixed capital formation, since 1994. What's interesting to note over here is in real rand terms, this is 190% growth since 1994, which is quite significant, something I think indicates investment in the South African economy. But now if you look post-2009, a very interesting trend. You would expect that the economy is going through a downward phase, that gross fixed capital formation would have probably tapered off or at worst decreased, but it's actually increased, especially since 2011. You see those upward lines, I mean the line continuing general upward movement post-2008. And this is largely driven by the state, so the state investment, especially energy and transport infrastructure, driven by Eskom and Trump, in particular in some of our other parastatals in social and economic infrastructure. And this is part of the discussion most members were present yesterday, the countercyclical fiscal policy that the African government has embarked on post-2009. However, there are limits to this, the amount the state can spend, given that it needs to borrow to spend if it's not generating its own revenue. The NDP targets the 30% for gross fixed capital formation. Right now we're averaging about 22, just below 22%, which suggests that we're still a bit far off from our targets. Which sectors are people investing in? Not surprising, manufacturing, a significant investment. What this may also indicate in manufacturing is a further mechanization of manufacturing in this country. And we've seen that with gradual lowering of employment numbers in manufacturing. So, you know, FDI in some senses is a good thing, but it comes with other challenges. So if industry decides to mechanize rather than employ more labor for whatever reason, then, you know, if you have surplus labor, and that's not great for employment. What's not surprising for certain people is the investment in financial services. People would remember Barclays coming in and taking a significant percentage of Absa, and similarly with the Chinese investment in Standard Bank. So the financial sector has been one of our performing sectors in terms of investment and growth, but it's not exactly going to create jobs for low-skilled individuals. Transport and logistics are a lot driven by the state as well. What's disappointing has been investment in agriculture and construction. And that's something to think about. Similarly with mining, if this was formerly a very strong mining economy, investment has been relatively low compared to other sectors since 1994. Who invests in South Africa? And this is very important because people overemphasize certain countries and don't realize that there's still a high concentration of investment in terms of source. European Union, or rather Europe as a whole, 78%, very, very significant. This is region ownership of stock in the country. USA, 7%, a bit more modest. Africa and China, very small, full 3%. Although a lot has been made of the China's resurgence and investment on the continent, it's mostly outside South Africa. Even some of our satellite neighbors have seen some investments, but less so in this country. And then portfolio flows into South Africa have increased very significantly since 1994. This is partially because the global economy is changing and the nature of the economy is changing. Money chases yields, even if it doesn't result in job creation or value add, so to speak. But I mean, people want returns on their investment. And so you've seen very significant increase in portfolio inflows into this country, almost as high as FDI inflow into this country. And the actual value of portfolio investment in this country, is essentially money sitting on the stock exchange, is actually higher than FDI in this country in terms of stock. Rather interesting developments, and not surprising, but in terms of its own risks. Excuse me? Well, if you compare those, I compare absolute value in real rand terms. If you were to add portfolio investment as well as total FDI, portfolio investment is more than 50%. Portfolio flows into South Africa, this is a bit different to the previous graph, still dominated by Europe, but here America has a larger share given a lot of your hedge funds, pension funds, sit in the U.S., and there's a bit of a political economy content to this as well. People have heard of a company called PIMCO, one of the world's biggest pension funds. And so quite often National Treasury visit these funds, and they have engagements, what hedge funds, what people who hold portfolios do exercise some degree of control, and one needs to consider them in our decisions as a country, given that we are dependent on portfolio flows. And in the United Kingdom, also very significant 30%. So this is still very much the old world, so to speak. You know, your traditional powers, your traditional trading partners, Britain, the UK, and the United States. Thank you very much. Those are the numbers that we pulled out for this country and for the parts allocated to us. If there are any questions, points of discussion, we'd like to continue on this.
Thank you very much to our PPO. No, I'm not going to be distracted. There is a bigger assignment here that needs my attention. So could I please be allowed to entertain this assignment? Because this is my bottom line. The other things are right away. Thank you very much once more. Could we please say, gain your audience? Members, there we are. Those are the findings of the study. Let's engage. Honorable Ross, Honorable Tandy, Honorable Gongwa, and Honorable Makosi in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. You will recall that I made I did send a request to the PBO with regards to factors inhibiting investment. And this broad overview also gives us that indication. For me, it's very clear that in terms of the gross fixed capital formation and since what happened in 2008, which is clearly, and I agree with you, it's state investment driven, that we need to look at why other private sector perhaps and just take it down a little bit is the problems in the agriculture with regards to policy and in mining with regards to labor, and you can clearly see how it reflects in the graph on the gross fixed capital formation. But also the very interesting is the energy crisis, which reflects on the previous graph, the foreign direct investment and growth. That, you know, you can clearly see how it improved since 1994, of course, and then in 2008, the spike was quite prosperous, and then it suddenly dropped down to almost, if I put it, just below 1% in 2010. And that shows you the lack of confidence in terms of the energy crisis of 2008. And then very encouraging is to see that since 2010, if I'm correct, that it's increased slightly to 2012 and then 2013. And I would just like to know whether that increase in the spike of the current position is perhaps in 2014. But could I just ask the presenter, it's a very useful presentation that you did. Can we perhaps have the full presentation with all your slides and information? If that could be sent to members. And I would really congratulate the PVO in terms of the job done, in terms of this, the feedback and the depth of the detail provided to us. And I think we can be very encouraged with this part of the presentation, and it is indeed very informative.
Yeah, definitely. Some soft copies we have, because we such not especially graphic area are not helpful when they're in black and white, you know. But if we get soft copies, that's the rest of the next. Let's pick up.
Chair, I need to make a write-up from the onset that what I'm going to say is my personal view. It's not the view of my party, and I want to be protected from anybody who will want to repeat what I said anywhere, including my friends from the GA and my friend from the ANC. I just want to speak my mind. Am I?
No, and you are welcome. That's why we are here. That's why you are here. Could you please be allowed to chair this meeting?
Yeah. Protect me from my calls, man.
Okay. Okay.
Chair, let me say this from an onset. Economic assumptions are nothing else but assumptions, right? Sometimes you will think that you are correct in terms of your assumptions, but sometimes those assumptions will not work. That's why we change the economic policy based on the experiences on the ground. Now, this is a very interesting debate. There are people who hold a view that for an economy of a country to thrive, we need foreign direct investment. Then there's another view that says, basically, if you have domestic investment, you will thrive. So these are two contending views. Now, let's look at both arguments and the repercussions of any of the two when implemented. And I'm gonna try to make practical examples of what happened. For instance, South Africa was sanctioned in the 80s because of its policy of apartheid. But South Africa was able to do local investment. There was domestic economic activities that sustained the country, whether in a positive or in a negative way, it's immaterial. But you had local firms who were active and doing business on a daily basis. There had to be pressure in different ways to sabotage it, to make sure that actually it addresses the needs of the entire population. That's how we succeeded. It had to be sabotaged, but it was there. And one example was the Central West Cooperative, for instance, and your Volkswagen Bank and all those kinds of investments that were there, right? Now, there's a view that says foreign direct investment stimulates economic growth because it creates jobs and so on. It was based on the fact that at that time, when that was conceived, there was financial limitation. The democratic state inherited a bankrupt government at the time. So they had to focus, for instance, on foreign direct investment to stimulate economic growth. Right? But the argument that the research team is raising is that, are we still in a good path to continuously look at foreign direct investment as a mechanism to economic growth? They argue that we should be inwardly looking, and if I can tell you the truth, I agree. But don't repeat it anyway, because they are challenging the political economic policies that we have in the current conjuncture. That's what they are doing. They are saying actually what you are running around doing there is not working, let's focus inwardly. That's what they are saying basically. Now, I need to be explained what is the difference between capital inflows and foreign direct inflows, because to me it seems like it's the same thing. But here you overemphasize on gross fixed capital formation. We had to do that because we didn't have our own locally manufactured machinery. The intellectual property of South Africa in terms of input products that you needed was not there at all. Even in the agricultural sector, we still import machinery to be able to have agricultural activity.
And in actual fact, the observation I made, I might be wrong, I can be assisted by the research team, is to look at whether the agricultural sector itself is not mechanizing or not. Because in my opinion, if you look at the type of machinery they use in the current conjuncture, it's far more different from what they used before. It actually takes jobs from people who were doing manual labor at the farm level. And if you want to compete internationally with international products, especially made in the European Union, you will have to update the standards. So we're having a very complex economic environment in South Africa, where we have this surplus of labor, quite a huge amount of it, that's highly unskilled, that you cannot even employ in the financial services, but to look at your primary sectors, for instance, and one of them, the secondary sectors, for instance, one of them being manufacturing. And that's where there's been lack of investment, if you agree with me, Rashad. The manufacturing sector has not been performing well, and in my view, if there is more investment in it, production of clothing, production of leather products, blah, 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 basic things that the consumer needs on a daily basis, it will make an economic sense. So that's basically the view I came to. If you need local economic activity, and it's a campaign I led, Eunice, proudly South Africa, buy local campaign. I led the campaign. Because there's a perception from consumers that constitutive consumption it gives you pride. If you're wearing a designer a jersey by Louis Vuitton, blah, 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 who is not necessarily a South African designer, you know. So that's promote import. Because the consumer focus outwardly than local. If you look at the agricultural sector, the majority of farmers, they wear shirts that has been manufactured by local people, the cattle shirts that they always wear. They do that religiously. Here in Cape Town, there's a company, a Muslim company, producing a soft drink called Jive. If you go to supermarkets here, you see that most of the people who buy that, it's local. I want to ask my husband, where is this soft drink manufactured? It's actually it's owned by a Muslim family, and all Muslims religiously will ignore the Coca-Cola product and buy this one. Huh? You also have?
Yeah, we have Coke.
I want to buy Coke also. I'll buy Coke. Yeah. I don't think drinks at all. Now, we need to also change the perceptive mind. If, for instance, Rashad, I used to argue with my sister that when I'm in my hometown, I observe people living locally produced, fresh produce, like pumpkin or tomatoes, and take a taxi to go and buy it somewhere in town, when there's actually a fresh organic one that has been produced that doesn't have to be put in a refrigerator and be transported for kilometers and kilometers. So if you're talking about local investment, it starts with buying from the tax shop in your street and not running to buy a pick and pay somewhere in town. I used to insist in the office, for instance, that if we're going to have lunch, we're going to have a mama from the street who cook for us and we eat that and not go to Woolworths. It was a norm in the office. Because that's local investment. So you change the perception, and also, I differ where you say that a local investor will tend to invest in forward and backward linkages, because let's talk about my Shuttleworth. This brother takes money made in South Africa and wants to take it offshore. And that's not patriotic at all in this context. And it actually says it's not guaranteed that a local investor will actually invest in forward and backward linkages at the same time. It will be a point where we, as the private sector and the public sector, come together and discuss this matter so that the public sector does not become the primary employer. And you look at this as a scenario where you have a situation where, in percentage terms, there isn't much local activity. And changing, and now I'm going to switch off the microphone.
lawyers and DAOs approach, we should have a basket of mixed options. And I want to hear your opinion on that. To me, it's not about moving from Europe and concentrating. It's about having a mixed approach to balance your activities so that you do not really remove the primary source of your economic activity and think that you have that. Because each and every country has its own interests at heart. It has its own development. You can be friends, it's fine, but as long as I gain more from the friendship, that's good for me.
So, where is the middle ground? Okay.
I'm not sure why the mic got switched off. There's no subversion in our submission.
No. I know you people. I know you people that you record everything that
all
you
right,
say.
Well,
you record everything that you say. You see, there's always books in our meetings. So.
I think what Tanya has done when she switched off the mic, she said exactly what the National Development Plan said.
Fine. It's fine.
That's a good
it's fine. He is becoming political, and that's why I switched off the mic, because he will not call me and say that I said it, because it was not on the mic. Because, you see, there's a debate about whether we follow the Gold Path or the NDP, and we created these policies, and then we now differ, and then we give others an opportunity to take us to talk with them. That's why I switched off the microphone.
You can proceed.
So, I would want a situation where our team says, balance both, because there's always unintended consequences with any other economic assumption. There is no clear benefit. You can cite many examples. And the historical factors of this country have led to a situation where there is no a clear relationship between business and government. For instance, I can tell you of incidents where private business people will just go and want to invest somewhere else without even looking at the government policy or even involving its own government when they do that. And it leads to such challenges where at some point the government needs to intervene because this investor went haywire and then they are experiencing problems there. And so we need that support. We need to be one, both as private business and government, in policy formulation and implementation. And we need their resources because we've got limited resources. That's basically my argument. You can take me to task. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm sure the reason why Honorable Tandi is still right, because remember, the NDP has now become the DA's favorite document. Yes, the thank you very much, Chair. I think the challenge is that, obviously, during your research, you couldn't find a clear, positive or linear relationship between FDI and economic growth, or to be able to track the causal relationship. Because, for example, you're saying there are instances where economic growth was high and FDI was low, and there are also instances where FDI was high and economic growth was high. So it's very difficult to come to a conclusive decision as to what is the track or the causal relationship. But I think what is important when we face with a situation like this is that we would have to depend to a large extent on the, you know, positive spillover effects of the economy. But I think what I would like to actually hear from you is when you are doing your literature review and your research, were you able to pick up or to identify whether or not there are some instances where FDI or the competition for FDI has actually triggered a race to the bottom in terms of lower standards for workers and the environment as well. But the other issue that people normally complain about is were there instances here in South Africa where, let's say, companies actually plowed money or took over certain industries and ended up with undue influence in that market, right? And in those instances, have we then as a country been able to deal with those problems to ensure that we protect other companies that operate in the same market in the same space? Thank you very much.
Yes, another question.
No,
no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no, no
format because, you know, I'm so obsessed with this name.
Yeah, I think
my sincere apologies. I have only had one meeting for that name.
No, but honestly,
I'm drowned. I'm not even obsessed. I'm drowned. All right, thank you, Honorable Makosi.
I'm not gonna go there. No, he's also former.
Looking at the trends that South Africa is beginning to go through, and And I know that Walmart, is, for example, is coming with that. You go to Makro. You go to Makro. You now have to buy your Coke, whatever. They are the ones that actually introduced this thing of buying one, get one free. You know? It's really encouraging that consumption, that consumptive culture and so forth. So I'm saying, as much as we are looking at these issues, yes, I agree with you, Honorable Member, that you can't say completely you are not, we are not in an isolated island here. We still do need direct foreign investment. But I think somehow we need to engage about what kind of DFI do we want. It's not just, you know, a free for all, but also we need to address our own domestic problems. And I'm saying this probably, maybe I'm like you, Tali, I don't know, but I mean, I'm already in trouble, so I'm not worried. Yeah, I'm already down. But there are issues that we definitely have to start addressing.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we like it or not, I know that we do tend to favor. Yes, I agree. The state has a role to play. But you must also remember that the state, if you have an economy that is driven too much by the state, it can also drive the inflation up. And there are trade-offs that we need to make here, because you almost have to balance things out. And I am saying, somehow I just feel as if this debate is much bigger than us, but it's a debate that is absolutely necessary. But because we are this committee, I don't think we should be apologetic about engaging on these issues. Because these issues are critical. And right now, we are at a stage where we have to begin to make those trade-offs. All the graphs that we've been seeing are just telling us that, hang on a sec, we've got to go back to the drawing board and review where are we going, what is it that we are not doing right, and probably begin to scrutinize that. Basically, the final point that I just wanted to make is that I just wanted to check with you whether you have really looked at the trade liberalization in particular. That's going to be something that I would love to hear. What is your take on that? Because in this country, there is no one that has the correct answer. I know that the MI come with things that they have. Privatization is the solution. In this country, you need to balance things out. Because you there is no one size fits all. You almost have to balance these things out, because even our state space is very low. Our entrepreneurial culture is very bad. There are so many fundamentals that are not right, that you can't wish away the role of the state. The state still has to play some role, but to what extent can the state play a role? And how do you create the space for the private sector? Because real growth is going to have to come from there.
All right, Honorable Nkoma. Members, just to caution you, it's 8 minutes to one. So we'll continue, but be conscious of the fact that we are temporary with our own lunch time. Honorable Nkoma.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think Chairperson of the meeting.
Let's allow Honorable Nkoma to make the point.
Chairperson of the meeting for today, I would like to thank you for giving me this opportunity. I would just like to stress that I am impressed with how we are addressing matters in this committee. You know, we are actually going for the crux of the matter
now chairperson, that when we engage with documentation that we have received, we actually become quite honest and open about matters. I'm truly, should I put it like, I'm truly amazed at how we have actually gone, chairperson, I think it's about 5 months now, starting in May, and how much is being shown by this committee of yours that is now the real chairperson sitting next to you, acting chairperson. I'm actually saying this because, chairperson, this committee, it seems to be a committee that is going to be seized by a lot of work, noting what actually transpired early this morning when we're dealing with the ASB board and this report that we're having, as well as other reports. I must say, chairperson, that just before I leave, because I'm leaving in half a minute, that we are definitely doing very well. It's important for us to really engage with matters. I'm grateful for everything. Yeah, I'm quite grateful, chairperson. Thank you.
Chair. Yeah, very quick. It's not a contribution, it's a request, actually. I think it's actually become a national anthem for us smaller parties to apologize all the time. I was late because I came from the Chief Whip's Forum meeting, and now I have to go to the Quarterly Consultative Forum. So I want to extend my apology and request that I be allowed to leave, Chair. But before I do, so I would like to say that, you know, I think if we were to go back to the drawing board, I think we should go back to the UDM, DA, and IFP drawing board. The ANC is just a lot of those, but we're still back to square one.
Honorable Ross?
Yeah, I think I must also make a winning statement that go. Listen, I was very impressed with especially the last presentation, that we have to address the critical issues, and I think, and certainly we have to find a balance in terms of the role of the state and private sector, and I mean the state definitely has a role to play, but certainly so does the private sector in terms of the objectives on getting those jobs done. But I think in terms of foreign direct investments, we have a lot to learn, and thank you very much for a very good presentation once again.
Call me Unison, I'm not here to say. You know what, I want to make a very profound statement, as I usually do, right? And it is this, that there are not two formers here. There are actually five formers. You are the only non-former here. If you look at Bakrosi, former chair of scope. If you look at Dick and Lady, former MEC. If you look at Pinky, former MEC. So we know where this committee is. Okay, so on a more serious note, look, I also want to echo what. No. I'm not sharing here. Look, I really think you've done a very good job. Not just the content, it's the way you present. So you also explain concepts clearly. It helped me a lot, actually, I must say. I really like what you did, like everybody did. Really, it's great. You see how much you've stimulated, how you brought out. The quality of a presentation is not just the words on paper. It is the extent to which you draw out from other members the best that they can summon. And I entirely agree with Makosi. You know, what she's basically saying is what I also feel, and I'm sure, these are especially uncertain times. And there are no simple answers. If you look carefully at Treasury, it's also fumbling and floundering, not because of the quality of the leadership there. It's because of the quality of the times. There are no answers, actually. Look at the Eurozone as well. I don't want to go into all of that. What I do think, Comrade Chair, is that we can't leave this discussion hanging in the air. Obviously, we infuse our understanding and processing of bills and whatever else we have to deal with issues, but I think what you should do, to the extent it's possible, and I can assist and maybe others can, is to take this discussion forward. So what I suggest you do is to draw out some of the issues that have arisen in the discussion for a follow-up. Now, you can do it in the next 10 days or so, but exactly where we slot you in, we'll have to find out. But you see, it's also possible that when you come back, it'll be a dead, moribund discussion, because it's also about momentum. You've created a momentum here. It doesn't mean we can recover the momentum a week from now, let alone 6 weeks from now, but let's try. The second point I want to make, you see, if you listen to Tandi and Makosi, right, the thing that strikes you yet again is how much politics is really.
the art of finding the right balances. You know, that's what it's really about, the right trade-off. If you look also, the thing that strikes me from the chair, is if you look at that chart, it's very striking. I think the maximum investment occurred on the eve of the 2010 World Cup. And that's the same time, actually, that we got hardly any FDI. So actually it's our own investment, possibly, right? That's very striking. The thing that strikes me politically, those people who struck for gear, whatever we think about gear, right, they oriented themselves almost wholly towards FDI. Then even they, I think around 2004, 2005, if you look into listen to President Mbeki and Minister Manuel at the time, they let this guy, what's his name, I told you all to talk, and began to actually adjust and say, look, we've done everything that the IMF and World Bank wants. However, wait is the FDI coming in. So let's move towards a more state-led growth path. Now we're in a situation where we don't have the resources to have a state-led growth path in the way you might have wanted with the development space. So now we're getting to FDI. But you see, if you listen to Makosi, I think she's absolutely right to say, it's not, it didn't strike me before, but it struck me now as she spoke. It's not about FDI, it's about the quality of the FDI. The example she uses, I didn't know that it created 100 jobs, and I'm aware of that project in Musundusi, right? There's a good example. Then the example she used before when Minister Nene brought it to our attention, if you look at the amount invested in the Eastern Cape, in the automobile industry, how many jobs it created, right? So in short, what I'm saying is, this discussion mustn't be left hanging there. I'll suggest the way forward, think about it, and we move forward. Can I make one or two announcements before you conclude, Chief?
No,
yeah, so one announcement is I think you might know if you haven't already. The Minister and Deputy Minister are unfortunately not available tomorrow afternoon. So the DBSA bill has been postponed. No, we're not debating tomorrow. Right. Secondly, there is a request from Cindy August on behalf of the Minister that we process one of the protocols with trade, the agreements, as you got the letter, right? That we can do. The second one is to juggle around the DBSA. I don't know why they agreed with you and have now changed the mind. Can you sort that out? But the third one is one I want members to apply their mind to. Unless, you know, people say a million things, Comrade, unless I missed it, and maybe Cindy told me, there was no proposal for a bill coming this quarter. We were told that at most you will get the first draft of the 20th legislation. Did you know anything about this bill? Now, suddenly we are given a bill yesterday and asked to please see if we can have public hearings and so on, with a deadline of passing it by the 1st of April next year. What I'm suggesting, colleagues, think about it. I'll send you the letter if you want. But I really think it's pushing things too much. At most, what we can do is get a briefing. But to have a public hearing and all that takes a while. We have a public hearing late in January. In any case, the first week or two before the State of Nation address is actually what you call committee meeting. Moreover, what we can do to facilitate the bill, if it's NCOP's role, is try to have joint public hearings with the NCOP so that we can fast track it. We've delivered bills before very quickly, rather than having public hearings now. So can we please, so the chairs and groups have got a 4-day education, and it's cutting into our program and so on. I don't think we're going to be available for the last committee week chairs and groups from the ANC side, from what I can tell, but there's no more. And finally, 12:30 to 2 tomorrow is the consideration of the report. Please, you must try to finish it tomorrow, otherwise we'll have to deal with it on Friday. Thank you, colleagues.
All right, members, this under the time when we are to deal with the fiscal framework report. And I know that there is an undertaking that we need to come up with a report that will obviously temper with the status quo. So that simply says these are some of the ideas that you are picking up from this presentation, some of the ideas that must find expression in the final report that will be generated by this committee. Well, as to how we're going to use this particular analysis and advice to enhance our work going forward, this is something that I think we'll have to engage, because I fully agree with the chairperson that it's not going to help to receive this analysis and then from there it becomes business as usual. You know, so we need to find a way of ensuring that we use this
production, I mean, to enhance our work. It might also not necessarily be the finance standing committee alone. We must also have to think how do we rope in other relevant committees or maybe the class as a whole on some of these findings, you know, analysis or advices. Because from where I'm sitting, I think the product that has cut across is not only about our committees, also about other committees. So I think at some stage we don't need to apply our mind on this and see how do we take advantage of this good work and enhance our work as the committees of Parliament. With those few words, members, thank you very much, PDO, and also thank you very much, members, I mean, for ensuring that we have a successful meeting, I mean, for our committee. Thank you very much, and this meeting is officially adjourned.
Thanks to the wonderful chair.